is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded, May the 1st, 2014. I would now like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Professor Liz Laub. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. It's 5:30 in Sydney, so you can't see me sitting here with my fluffy slippers, but I have put my lipstick on, which means we're well and truly ready to go. So moving to slide number 2, I would firstly like to begin by acknowledging my investigators on this study, Dr. Christine Sanderson, Dr. Jane Moll, Professor Phyllis Buteau, Naomi McGowan, who very capably undertook the interviews in this study, and Dr. Melanie Price. I think the study that I'm going to present today will be of particular interest because we had some surprising findings. That's one of the things that I love about research, is that you don't know quite what's going to happen when you start out, but I'm hoping that by the end of the presentation that we will have perhaps some indications as to how we might go forward on this particular topic. So moving to slide 3. I want to begin by giving an overview of the literature in this particular area, looking at caregivers, particularly in oncology and palliative care. Slide 4. So when there is a diagnosis of a life-threatening or a life-limiting illness, family members are often called upon to provide both emotional and practical support. And many of them report that they feel quite unprepared for this role. It's really foreign territory for them, a whole new language to be learning, a whole new hospital system to have to navigate. And of course, sometimes the person with the illness may be the main breadwinner in the family, or it could be that a carer has to give up work so that they can support their loved one. And so there can be within the family financial distress. And of course, as there's disease progression, existential distress around the uncertainty of the future, sometimes an indeterminate prognosis, makes this very difficult territory. And of course, the longer the illness and the caring role, the physical health of the caregiver can worsen, and sometimes even putting their own health at risk. And of course, often, particularly in cancer, which can occur in older people, the carer themselves often can have comorbidities. They can have other illnesses that are going on. So that's important to be aware that this is happening in the background. Moving on to slide 5. Studies have been done which can actually predict what may be behind some of the caregiver distress. And of course, cancer or any life-threatening illness doesn't always occur in isolation. It occurs when other things are going on in people's lives. And we know that these stresses, which could be a divorce, many of these older carers could be perhaps caring for elderly parents. There's sometimes the stresses of and the angst of teenagers who may be at home. And so if there are particular life stresses going on, this can further increase the distress of the caregiver. We know not just from oncology but from other health situations that poor social support and lower socioeconomic status can also be a predictor of distress. And studies particularly in breast cancer have shown that younger women understandably, if they have younger children, can also, that can be a predictor of distress. There are some personality traits, such as lower optimism. And of course, there are studies now coming out, particularly around attachment theory and bereavement, that can suggest that closer the caregiving relationship with the patient, the higher the level of distress. And of course, as the person gets sicker, this distress increases, and particularly as the patient has more physical impairment and moves on to a need for palliative care. Moving on to slide 6, I want to talk a little bit about the distress around bereavement. And I think it's really important that we look at some of the complications associated with grief, because to understand these gives us the potential to improve the well-being of palliative care caregivers. We know that those at risk of a difficult and prolonged bereavement can have poorer long-term physical and mental health outcomes. There's been a lot of the literature around what was initially complicated grief and is now being renamed prolonged grief disorder. And certainly studies that have been done around bereavement issues in the palliative care caregiver population have found anxiety, depression, prolonged grief disorder, and of course Professor David Kassane's work on demoralization. Moving to slide 7, I want to now give you a background to the participants in our study. These were caregivers who were participating in the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study on Quality of Life. This is a much larger population-based epidemiological study collecting, for example, tissue samples after surgery for ovarian cancer. And this larger study recruited around 1,500 women with primary epithelial ovarian cancer from across Australia. So this is a national study. And we had ethical approval to interview a subgroup of these carers, and we conducted interviews at 6 months and at 18 months, and the data I'm presenting today is the 6 month interview. So approximately 5 months after the woman died, we sent the caregivers a letter, and we also invited them to participate in this study. I know that I've got an informed audience, so I'm not going to go into the background on ovarian cancer, but I do want to particularly highlight some of the quality of life issues that arise that are particular to, I think, this disease. It does place a significant burden on patients on their and their caregivers because of its high mortality rate. And the treatment is complex, it's prolonged, and it's multimodal. And, of course, characterized by multiple recurrences. The women have received many lines of chemotherapy. And we know that there's evidence that there's decreasing duration of benefit over time. And I think what makes it particularly difficult for these women, and there's certainly been studies that have been done about the anxiety around, you know, the 1-2-5 levels going up, that there's wide variability in survival of these women who have perhaps similar disease characteristics and similar treatment, and we don't quite understand why these women respond differently, and this can also add to the burden on both patients and their caregivers. Moving to slide 9, the aims of this particular study was to look at the quality of dying and death of these women. Particularly, we wanted to assess the quality of the dying and death experience from the carer's perspective, and also to explore their concept around what they perceived to be a good death. And I have that in inverted commas, because that's certainly a language we use. But for many people, of course, the death that they may experience of a loved one could be the first time for them that someone close to them has died. We who work in palliative care, of course, may have a very different definition of what we perceive as a good death. So it was very important to get the partners and carers' experiences of this. Moving on to slide 10, which is the design. Obviously, this was a qualitative study, and we used generally procedural directions from what's called grounded theory research. We conducted semi-structured interviews, and they were around about 45 minutes in length. We recorded them and transcribed them verbatim. And I think this last point is really important for those who are doing this sort of research, is that it's really important, given the sensitivity and the distress that's often experienced by these bereaved caregivers, that it's done by an experienced researcher. In this case, it was an experienced psychology graduate, but she also had regular supervision by the clinical supervisors after the interviews had been conducted. Slide 11, just to give you some background on the interview schedule, we developed a number of questions from the following domains around information and decision-making, communication issues, and the ones that we were particularly interested in are these last four, which is preparation for death, the last weeks of the woman's life and of their caring, the end-of-life care that they received through palliative care services as well as from the carers, and the death itself. And some of the questions we asked, for example, was it a difficult death? What factors do you think are important for a good death? And would anything have made this experience better, more peaceful for you? Slide 12, the analysis. We obviously, because we had quite a lot of data, we uploaded them into a software program called Envivo, which doesn't analyze, it really organizes your data. So you then do the very difficult work of coding and reading the data line by line, comparing, linking the data, looking for codes and themes that may be developed. You check with your coder around validity, and so it's a very rigorous and often time-consuming process, but that's the work of qualitative studies, and of course it was analysed based on grounded theory using this constant comparative method of looking for constant themes that came up through the interview data. So, the next slide, interesting picture, it's not quite dawn here, but there was one thing that particularly stood out in the demographics of this sample. So if we move to slide 14, what you can see there, we had 32 participants in the study, but the mean age of the carers were 58, which is quite young, and the mean age of the patient was 61. What's particularly, I think, useful about this data is that you can see that in the gender, 64% of the carers were male and 36% female. And while that's important is that in so many of these studies, our population are Anglo-Saxon women, middle-aged women, usually upper economic status who tend to participate in these studies. And so it was really helpful, particularly in bereavement studies. There's really not a lot of data that looks at male experiences and also male experiences of caregiving. So this gave us particularly nuanced data, I felt. As you can see from the location, it was a national study, but really a quarter of the participants came from palliative care services in New South Wales and Victoria and fewer from the other states. Moving on to slide 15, nothing particular to report to there, except I guess my earlier background was looking at BRCA 1 and 2 in familial breast and ovarian cancer, and I was very conscious in doing that work that we really had a highly educated population, and I guess that was why these women were able to seek out genetic testing. They knew all about it, they knew where to go, they knew the implications of it, but we found that in this particular group they tended to be for example, you know, around half of them were educated at year 10 or below. And not that many who had university or higher degree, and with a higher percentage, obviously, who had had technical or trade education. On slide 16, let's now move on to some of the results and the themes that we identified. So the themes that related to effective service provision that would ensure a good death, according to these caregivers, included the importance of communication between the patient, the carer, and with the family generally, that pain and symptoms were well managed and that suffering was minimized. And there's nothing particularly new about that. Other studies have identified those themes. Slide 17, continuing. It was important for these carers that both the carer and the patient knew what to expect in terms of end-of-life processes and when these may occur. And I think this is where some of the key learnings are going to come out of this study. Also that they had an awareness of the imminent death to provide an opportunity for communication and decisions that needed to be made. And importantly, that there was a sense of acceptance about the death and that the death was peaceful. And as I progress into some of the quotes on this study, we can see that this wasn't always the case. Slide 18, the aspects of communication that were identified included acknowledging the different communication needs of patients and carers. Often the carers would say that the patients would be given information but it wouldn't necessarily be translated through to them. And I was having a conversation with an oncologist who looks after a number of women with ovarian cancer, and she made the observation that for many of these appointments, the woman would come with a female companion, that often the male partner would not be with her and so wouldn't necessarily hear what was happening, what the treatment plan was, what was happening in terms of disease progression. And so there was this dissonance, I guess, between the information that carers had and that patients had. They wanted to be given an explanation of what to expect of the dying process, and importantly, there was a need for open communication about ceasing treatment. On slide 19, particularly looking at lack of information, as this particular male carer said, and we did do some quantitative measures as well, particularly looking at complicated grief, and this male carer screened positive for complicated grief at both the 6-month and the 18-month interview. But he said it was the not knowing what was happening and how long it was going to go on for. We had no idea what sort of time frame we were looking at and of the physical deterioration that would eventuate. No comprehension of that whatsoever. Slide 20, particularly difficult quote about ceasing treatment, and you can imagine the distress in this family rushing around on a Saturday morning trying to get to chemists. And this female carer said, my dad went to get the sodium fluid bags that you put in a drip, and the chemist didn't have them, they'd been ordered. She said, look, we don't have any in. And this is, I think, around the communication. But also you can see the distress. I think sometimes maybe I should have rung around the hospitals and got hold of them. This all happened before I arrived, and the palliative care nurse said to my parents, oh, it doesn't really matter. But I think it could have made her more comfortable, and she may not have died for a few more hours or whatever and been in more comfort instead of being dehydrated because they basically removed the drip. So no communication there about the implications of this. Slide 21, around information of the dying process. And this female carer said, no one told us that being so short of breath when the lungs filled out, that this was common. It would be nice to know what to look out for so we could make a decision earlier than having to wait for the last minute and take her into the hospital at 3 or 4 in the morning. And then another male carer, again testing positive for complicated grief, she just literally stopped breathing. And there was an unbelievable change in her body. I think I probably would have liked to have known beforehand what her body was going to be like after she died. Slide 22, a theme that came through very strongly through all of the interviews was about pain control. And when it was not well controlled, this was certainly seen as a barrier to a good death. And as this carer said, it was a difficult death inasmuch she was in a lot of pain. She was no longer mobile. Even getting to the toilet was almost impossible. She had lost her dignity. But I think she was beyond caring at that stage. Pain relief was a big issue. She was in a lot of pain, and sometimes it didn't work quickly as she'd hoped, but the final moments were as peaceful as you could wish them to be. Slide 23. What was a very strong theme, and I think this particularly comes through with male carers and this need to feel useful, to be able to do something, and it was particularly important for these carers to have kept promises. You know, that to have been there, to have kept the woman at home for as long as possible, the sense of being there as a family, being there as a carer to care for the person who was dying, to talk to them, to be able to touch and hold them, and to have nothing left unsaid. And as this, you know, really quite lovely quote said, she had her 5 grandkids there, my brother and I and her daughter-in-law, and she was pretty good, really. She was not in pain. And if I can try and wrap it up succinctly, the death offers an opportunity to say what you don't say when you think there are a lot of tomorrows. And so this need, particularly, although this is a female quote, for the male carers in the interviews came through very carefully. All I could do was to be there. You know, I promised that I would be there, that I would support her, that I would be there towards the end, that I'd do everything I possibly could. And, of course, it was then very distressing for these carers when, for whatever reason, the woman was then transferred from home into hospital. Slide 24. So there was something that was particularly strong that stood out for us as we were doing these interviews. On slide 25, and this was around the language that we thought was very strongly suggestive of PTSD. And as you may be aware, PTSD is an anxiety disorder, which can be a consequence of exposure to any trauma experience as a direct threat to the integrity of self, such as assault and disaster and accident, which is what we tend to hear of the most. But also there is evidence that it can occur in those who witness a life-threatening illness. It can be made a diagnosis of those who've witnessed trauma or are profoundly affected by the life-threatening illness of another. The diagnostic criteria emphasise feelings of helplessness, horror, the presence of intrusive and distressing recollections, along with coping responses that involve persistent avoidance of cues associated with the trauma and or emotional numbness. And it became very clear to us as we delved deeper and deeper into these interviews that this indeed was some of the language that was being used. So on slide 26, just a little bit more literature on where PTSD occurs outside of trauma. It's being identified following death in intensive care units, in family members witnessing failed cardiopulmonary resuscitation, in parents of children with cancer, and also there are studies around cancer patients themselves. And population studies of bereaved relatives suggest that PTSD may occur in between 15 and 40% of this particular group. And these group of studies were done in Denmark, and they identified some of the factors associated with this, such as personality traits, in particular negative affectivity, lack of social support, locus of control, those who have a high need to be in control of the situation, and that this predicted 57% of the variance in the PTSD severity, but full-time employment, perceived control, and a secure attachment style moderated the risk. But long periods of caretaking, high levels of somatization and disassociation were associated with increased risk of PTSD. Slide 28 then brought in our additional aim was to look if there was evidence suggestive of PTSD symptoms in this population of bereaved caregivers of women with ovarian cancer in what we would have considered to have been an anticipated and hopefully planned for death. We did a second lot of analysis where we coded the transcripts into parallel strands. One strand described the event and the experience that happened to the patient, which the interviewee or the carer witnessed, and the second strand described their perceptions of the events and the emotional response, so statements around they did this and I saw this or I said that. Slide 30, we were particularly looking for language consistent with PTSD. Evidence of possible triggers was sought among the descriptions of the experience of witnessing the death, particularly the distressing sights and sounds and smells associated with dying. Slide 31, the language of trauma. All interviewees used the vocabulary that was suggestive of some level of trauma. Words such as shock, horrible, traumatic, awful, surreal, couldn't believe it, felt helpless, it was horrendous, it was devastating. And this was conveyed in ongoing intensity of the acute experience and the emotions in these interviews where they seemed to be re-experiencing this as we were talking to them about what had happened at the time of their loved one's death. Slide 32, the language of impact. The frequent use of words that connotated a physical impact, such as it hit me very hard. Other phrases, I fell in a hole after the death, it was gutting. And also not unusually denoting just the very hard work of the last days or weeks that were reported as being grueling or just impossible. And these words recurred over and over again in almost every transcript in different combinations, and these words hard and difficult came through. Slide 33, the language of surprise. And it's important if we just reorient ourselves here that all of these caregivers who were interviewed were the primary caregivers of a woman with ovarian cancer, which we know is characterized by a long trajectory with episodes of recurrent disease and progression. We would assume that death is often predictable, enabling at least some opportunity for preparation for the loss. However, phrases such as, I didn't expect it, just didn't believe it, it happened very quickly, difficult to know what was happening, incredibly quick, hard to predict, you can never know, it wasn't the way that I predicted, I was not quite understanding, it was a blur, suggested that this was not the case, that these caregivers were not prepared for this woman's death. the language of surprise. Well, it was a complete shock. She was taken into hospital with what we thought was a bowel problem, and we thought it was just a blocked bowel, and so I wasn't overly concerned. And then they told us that it was the cancer that was causing it, and it couldn't be unblocked, and so she was going to die. It was a fairly horrible death, you know. I didn't expect it. And, of course, we know that bowel blockage occurs in, you know, around 52% of women with ovarian cancer. So this was a fairly common theme that came through in these interviews. And here you can see this, slide 35, sorry, on the language of physically witnessing this. You know, the vomiting that happened, the attempts to try and control the vomiting. And this particularly, you know, strong quote from this male partner. The children were there when she died, and it must have been horrible for them. I just looked around and I saw the look of horror on her son's face. Slide 36, again about witnessing, and this sense that, you know, the smell, the odours, the sense that death was in the room. I mean, death was in the room. It was just hanging. It was around the corner. It was gutting. I think you can smell death. My son said to me he couldn't go back into the room. He'd come and said goodbye, and he couldn't look at Nana again like that. Slide 37, looking particularly at intrusive memories. It's not something you'll ever forget, this carer said. For months after she died, I was just haunted by that last, you know, particularly that last week. I found it extremely difficult. I couldn't think of anything good. I'd try, but it was that last week that was pretty awful. The few hours before she died will live with me forever. And another says, the major problem I'm having at the moment, I'm just reliving over those, especially last 2 days. And so we're starting to see more and more this language that is often associated and experiences with PTSD. Slide 38, as I said, we did do some quantitative measures, looking particularly here at the carer's current grief experience. And many of these carers at the six-month level were experiencing high levels of grief. 64% of them had what's called syndromal levels of complicated grief, so that's a score of greater than 25. And of these, 14 of the 23 male partners. Slide 39, if you look at this across the time, so time 1, which is at 6 months, time 2 at 13 months, time 3 at 18 months. So sub-syndromal levels, so these are people who are at risk and may well go on to develop complicated grief. You know, you're looking at time 2, 54%, time 3, 47%. And the percentages of those who had syndromal levels, 64% at 6 months, 46% at 13 months, 43% at 18 months. So something is going on here in the experiences of these carers, and these are higher. The population levels for complicated grief, for those of you who are not familiar with the literature, are between 12 and 15%. So that something's happening here. Let's go on to slide 40. I live in Newtown in Sydney, and the graffiti on the wall is often amazing. So what did these carers talk about in terms of a good death? What represented for them a good death? And I think this quote on slide 41 sums it up very well. This male partner says, control in the end, making the actual decision to, you know, say no, no more treatment, no more. What is a good death experience? A lack of sort of trauma. Relative comfort for the person who's going, as much as can be achieved. Support from people around her or around them. So that's from the voice of the carer. Slide 42, a little bit about the literature, the definition. Certainly in the literature is elusive. It talks a lot about pain and symptom control. The support of family and friends, support of decision-making, the importance of spirituality, affirmation and care of the whole person, and that the death occurs in a nurturing environment. Slide 43, now this is where we get the really interesting data. We ask these carers to rate their overall perception of the quality of the health care that these women received, bearing in mind that all of these women were under the care of palliative care services. So the rating went from 1, which was the worst possible care, to 10, which is the best possible care. 60% of these caregivers scored 9 or 10 out of 10 around the quality of healthcare. 95% said that they'd received palliative care, 58% in a hospital, 42% at home. So it's not the perceived care that the women got that's causing this distress. If we go to slide 44, looking at the quality of death, again, an overall rating from 1 being worst possible to 10 being best possible. 11% of carers scored 7 out of 10, 38% 8, 13% 9, and 16% 10. So 65% said the quality of death was good at 6 months. So what do we make of this? And I think on slide 45, what it's telling us is that caregivers' perception of the quality of the death or the quality of care is not the same as their perception of how they experience the death as a traumatic event or otherwise. And this came back to my earlier comment about, you know, we see many deaths and we perhaps have a different definition, but for these caregivers, for many of them, this was their first experience of a death. So slide 46, is there light at the end of the rainbow, as they say? Slide 47, there was yes and no. We asked questions about self-appraisal, looking back on this experience. This female sibling said, I didn't get peace because I don't believe that someone goes to a better place. I think they just die. I mean, I don't know. It might be hard for you to hear me say these things, depending on your beliefs, but it's just an unnecessary, unfortunate thing that you can't stop. It's just such a negative event. There's not much positive. I don't think any positives come out of it, so I hope what I've said has been helpful. And perhaps that quote links back to one of those findings from the literature about the personality tray of negative affectivity. But it wasn't always like that. Here is a daughter that says, the last few weeks were probably a mixture of being very honest and rewarding, a very, very, very good experience if you can have a good experience when you're watching someone die. It was beautiful. I think I was relieved, actually. Oh, look, she taught us a lot, and I'm not sure that we've had the time to digest all of those lessons yet. So this was at 6 months after the death. Slide 49. It was very interesting to see, and we're about to look at the 18-month data to see if this was sustained, that the desire to repartner was strong. You know, 9 of the 23 male spouses mentioned the possibility or actuality of repartnering at the 6-month interview. This quote here, I would like to have another female in my life. And one of the things I'm confronted with is the moral aspect of the community at large. People have this wondrous idea that now is not the right time. It's damned easy when you've got people around you to make up the rules and how to live other people, how other people should live their lives. And so this came out from, you know, loneliness, but it was certainly, as we looked at, started to peek into the 18-month data, this was sustained. So slide 50, what can we conclude from these results? Let's try and make some sense of them. As I said, all of the patients were in contact with palliative care services, yet these interviews and these transcripts convey a picture of trauma associated with these seemingly expected deaths. The underlying emotional tone reveals that the expressions of distress and shock, and as the review has pointed out, because this article has been published in Palliative Medicine and they made the comment, yes, but these phrases are in common usage, and that's true, but they were repetitively present in this setting and in these interviews. Slide 51, conclusion. Our initial hypothesis is that an expected death has an inherent trauma within it, no matter how well families are prepared or symptoms are managed. And as I said earlier, that such trauma is not necessarily proportional to the quality, as is currently perceived by the caregivers, of the services provided. And it could be that the simple, in quotes, experience of waiting and watching while someone dies without making active attempts to prevent death may perhaps be unendurable for some individuals. Slide 52. These early studies, as I said, found factors such as personality and social support may affect the development of PTSD to a higher degree than the factors that related to the trauma of the death. However, there is evidence that preparedness for death and predictability of the loss could reduce the negative consequences of the bereavement experience. slide 53, there were some limitations in previous studies. The population the age tended to be older. A lot of the earlier studies, in particular, I'm thinking of the clock study that was done in America, looked at elderly spouses. There's often been a lack of a control group in these studies. Baseline data was not available, so it could be that there'd been pre-traumatic vulnerability. There may have been experiences in the past that had led to this. But certainly in our study, we're not suggesting, you know, causality can't be made. This is suggestive. This is not diagnostic. This was a surprise finding in our data. And so what we need to do, we need longitudinal data to look at the prospective role of factors that may be involved in long-term bereavement, including characteristics around the death. If we go to slide 53, you can see there are many ways we can go after this study, many tracks that we could take. And slide 55 starts to suggest some of those. As you would be aware, many families and clinicians themselves regard the palliative care approach to death as peaceful and a precious time for the dying person to spend with their loved ones. However, you know, for others, the palliative care phase may be characterized by feelings of shock and distress. So the first question we can ask, is this trajectory one of initial shock, followed by growth and resilience in the face of this existential phenomenon that perhaps is far beyond this individual's prior experience? Is this a type of trauma that has similar risk factors or outcomes to other complications of grief? And if that's the case, what preventative or treatment options might be feasible? Looking at slide 56, where do we go from here? Where, in fact, we had a meeting about this yesterday. We're going to look at a longitudinal study to follow up bereaved carers of, quote, an expected death and an unexpected death. And I've got this in quotes because having spent, you know, 27 years now as a bereavement counsellor, so many times, even when the person has been sick for a long time, that there's been preparation, that the death is being expected, when it occurs, the person will say, I didn't expect it, it was sudden. And that's, you know, so true. They can say, you know, it was sudden. I didn't think it would be today. I didn't think it would be Easter. I thought she'd last till Christmas. And so this concept of, you know, a sudden, unexpected death is not unfamiliar within bereavement, even if people are prepared. The moment of death can often be unexpected and a shock for them. But we want to compare planned and expected deaths within palliative care with unexpected deaths that are often sudden and traumatic that come through the coronial system. I have a postgraduate fellow at the moment who is a senior social worker in forensic medicine in the coroner's court. And so through Jane's work, we will have the opportunity to follow for 3 to 5 years people who have been bereaved through a sudden, traumatic and unexpected death. And then we will also follow through our palliative care services, and this will be obviously a much larger study, to look at the longer-term bereavement outcomes of carers who have been, we would hope, through the experience of a planned palliative care death. I want to particularly thank the participants who took part in this interview, the skill of Naomi, I think, in eliciting the quotes that came from this study was particularly relevant, I think, to where we go. That's the end of my presentation. We've got some good time, actually, and so I'd be very interested to hear your feedback. I presented this talk about a month ago now to a national bereavement conference, and it certainly generated a lot of questions about, you know, what could be happening here and what do we need to do differently. So I'll hand back to the moderator.